STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the show. Greg Kokel here, your host at Stand to Reason. Just coming off of an unbelievable weekend, our fourth annual Rethink Conference for young people in Southern California. And we just barely broke 1,500. Actually, I think it was 1,504. Unbelievable. It was a shock to me. I did not expect this many people to come. But every year we have grown from the first year, 300 and some, to the second year, 600 and change, to the third year, 1,100, and we had to move to a new venue because we were just blowing out the stops at the other church there in South Orange County. And this year, Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa hosted with us the conference. And I'll tell you, you know, I knew that we had a lot of people signed up. And when I got to the venue on Friday night, we started at 7, and I was there about 6:15. I was in the green room working with the staff, getting things in order. I was there with my daughter, and then I came in from the stage side from the green room and came down, and I looked in the venue, and the place was empty. It was almost a quarter till starting time, and the place was empty, and I thought, where is everybody? I thought we had a sellout crowd here, and there's nobody here yet. And then I found out that they don't open the doors until 6:45, and we're 2 minutes off of that. And actually, behind the doors and out into the courtyard were mobs and mobs of young people. And so my daughter and I took our seat in the front row so we'd have a good view. And when they opened the doors, the mobs just flowed in like a tsunami, filled with intensity and excitement, all of these young people. And guess where they headed for first? The front row. They all headed down trying to get the best seats possible in the front row, and they filled the stadium, the arena, the venue, up from the bottom up. You know, some churches are the kind of churches you got to get there early to get a seat in the back. Not these guys. They were thrilled to be there. And there was such a buzz as everybody flowed in. And I made a mental note. Yesterday was my 42nd spiritual birthday. And 2 weeks after I trusted the Lord, it was a Friday night, September 28th, 1973, and 2 weeks later, I was at Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa. That was the very first church whose threshold I crossed as a new believer, and I walked into that church for a concert, a Friday night concert, which was the mainstay back then during the Jesus Movement, and Calvary Chapel was the epicenter of the Jesus Movement, Chuck Smith. And Friday nights they had a concert. This was before the contemporary Christian music movement started. In fact, it pretty much started from Calvary Chapel. And they had groups like Daniel Amos and Love Song and others that would perform a concert, and then someone like Tom Stipe would give a message, an evangelistic message, and lots of people would come to Christ. And that night, my former sweetheart, who I was still pretty attached to at the time, came to commit her life to Christ. And my brother Mark and I had brought her to the conference, or to the, rather to the concert that night, and afterwards she prayed in the parking lot and has been walking with the Lord ever since in a magnificent way. But that was 42 years, 2 weeks, and two days from this big conference this last weekend, and I just thought it was a bit of divine irony that here this was the first church whose threshold I crossed as a new believer, and when I walked in, the place was filled with young people there, excited about Jesus. And now, almost 42 years, almost to the date later, The place is filled up with young people excited about Jesus at a Stand to Reason event called the Rethink Conference, Rethink 15, in Costa Mesa. To give you an idea, by the way, some of the response, it really went off without a hitch. Friday night, the event went to 10:30 on Friday night, okay, from 7 to 10:30. So none of this 7 to 9 business. It was a full evening, and then at 9 o'clock, the place was filled up the next morning, and even more people came who weren't able to make it Friday night but made it on Saturday. And let me just read some of the responses, because we got responses from parents and also from students. One parent wrote, "I'm sure you've heard how great the conference was from every attendee that has crossed your path, but I had to be another voice in the chorus. The quality of every aspect of the event that my son and I experienced was awesome. The topics were engaging, relevant, and diverse. And as the dad of a 17-year-old boy, I can't tell you how satisfying it was to hear him say the very best part of his week was going to Rethink." Oh, man, it's cool. "Thanks for putting together such a powerful event that I know strengthened both me and my son's faith. You guys killed it." Incidentally, I think... Are the videos for Rethink from Costa Mesa this last weekend, are they available on the web? Did they make those? Did they stream? I think they did stream it, but I don't know. I'll get back with you on that information. Not sure yet. Certainly, the recordings will be available through Stand to Reason. And but anyway, there was another. Let's see. Here's a school, a Christian academy. Five staffers brought 23 students, grades 6 through 12. And by the way, this happens a lot with Rethink, that large groups of people come, that is, a whole youth group or a significant portion of it with the group leaders or the teachers, in this case, five staffers, teachers at the academy. And 23 students from grades 6 through 12, who they said had their minds blown, and for some, again, a second time, at the 4th Annual Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. Here are some feedback from the parents and the students. So here's some thoughts from the parents. "Thank you, the parents of the students from the academy, thank you for a priceless experience for my son, one with eternal ramifications. I'm thrilled he got to go. I can't wait to talk to him when he returns." Another writes, "My daughter and I will have conversations for weeks, even months to come, as she processes what she heard and mulls it over. She usually gives me the big picture after I pick her up. The details come popping out anytime we're together." And another parent, "We're thrilled that our daughter has the chance to strengthen this aspect of her faith before she heads off to college. This is really an important stuff, and the availability of this trip is a big deal for our kids. We really appreciate it." Then students weigh in. The student says, that was the parents. Here's some of the students. "It was great. I really feel like my faith was strengthened. My ability to defend my faith has also been strengthened." Another writes, "I feel grateful for the Rethink Conference because it allowed me to reinforce my beliefs with intellectual reasoning. I would recommend it to anyone who is passionate about owning their own faith." And again, Rethink always does a great job leaving me feeling informed and loaded with facts. This year was no exception. And that's just I'm just scratching the surface here. It's the tip of the iceberg. We have a pile of response sheets where people wrote fabulous things and based on their wonderful experience at Rethink. Part of the reason I'm telling you this is I want you to, if you didn't get to go, I want you to save the date for next year, September 23rd and 24th. That's the Orange County Rethink Conference. I personally talked to two or three different groups that drove out from Phoenix. Another group that came down from Northern California. Let me think. I know there was some other. Oh, somebody flew in from New Zealand. So they get Southern California with the mix, too, so they made it a vacation. But they came all the way from New Zealand just for the conference. So you can mark the date. You may want to just make it a road trip and bring your kids or bring your youth group, whatever. You got a year to plan. But we also have another Rethink coming up in 4 weeks. The one we just had was the Southern California Rethink. The one coming up in 4 weeks is in Dallas. Let's see. That would be the 23rd and 24th in Dallas. And most of the same set of speakers that we had this weekend will be there in Dallas as well. So I'm talking J. Warner Wallace, John Stone Street, Brett Kunkel, Alan Schliemann, myself. I mean, it's just going to be a great lineup. And so if you're within striking distance or want to make a road trip to that, plenty of time to sign up. We already have, as of last Friday, over 400 people that have signed up for the first Dallas Rethink. 400 people, 4 weeks out. That's a great sign. So we're expecting great and mighty things for that event as well, and looking forward to that. What's the name of the church? Can you stick that up in the where that's being held? You can go to rethinkapologetics.com and get all the details. But the church is in North Dallas, and I'll get that for you as well. So we're looking forward to that. Now, I just mentioned that I had my spiritual birthday yesterday, and I want to spend some time here today, though I'm looking at the clock and looking at the callers on board. Maybe I will do this at the beginning of next hour. But 42 years old in the Lord yesterday, and I want to say thanks publicly to my brother Mark, who labored with me for quite a while to bring me to my understanding of Christ. But I don't think that I've ever talked about how I actually made that journey on the air. I think I know I've spoken at events before, and a talk I do called No Pixie Dust, which are the hard realities of spiritual growth. I go into detail on my own testimony to lay a predicate or a foundation for that talk. But I think what I'm going to do take a moment and we'll go to maybe break it just a little early here and then just jump into the calls. And then come back at the beginning of the second hour and take some more time to talk to you just exactly how I did come to know the Lord. And there are some aspects about it that I think are going to surprise you in light of where I find myself right now. So we'll come back to that in a little while. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back to the callers here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. After my recent trip to the Middle East, training Arab Christians in theology and apologetics, I was wondering, does God promise us prosperity or persecution? Find out my answer in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
Giving you a piece of my mind, as I do every week, the live show on Tuesdays from 4 until 6. Is that right? And we also have right after that the recording of our STR Ask, our Muscle Manos half-hour time with the enforcer, Melinda Penner, and me, and a rapid-fire series of questions, so that comes afterwards, too. And if you don't subscribe to that, if you don't receive that, be sure and download it, be a regular subscriber because you want to get that as well. Let's go to our callers, Jordan in Cameron, North Carolina. Hey, Jordan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. How's it going?
Good, good. I'm really excited about this last weekend. I'm just still riding high. It's a tremendous time.
Yeah, I bet. So I've been a Cocoite since 2007. And I have to say, you know, since I read the Tactics book when it first came out in 2009, you know, it's a blessing, but it's also a curse. And what I mean by that is when you get some clear thinking on how to process ideas, it can really get frustrating. Mm-hmm. Frustrating when you see how the average person thinks.
That's right. I agree with you entirely.
You know, and I'm kind of right there with you. I get to the point where it's hard to watch the news sometimes because you just cringe at some of the ideas that are presented.
Yes, I agree.
And along that line, somebody had shared on social media this week a video that Bill Nye had released, mm-hmm. In which he basically of his views against abortion, basically.
Wait, he's against, you're breaking up a little bit. He's against, say it again.
He's against the, he speaks against people who are anti-abortion.
Abortion, okay. What's interesting about this is that I'm actually doing a radio interview tomorrow that I have to respond one of the things they want me to respond to is this this clip. I haven't seen it myself yet, though, so can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what he says?
Sure. Now, admittedly,
Bill Nye is the science guy, right?
Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I didn't watch the whole 4 minutes. I got to a certain part and just kind of
got angry.
You know, yeah. And it's kind of the typical, you know, anti-religious rhetoric in there about you know, all these people who believe in a book that was written 5,000 years ago are going to be against abortion because of these silly reasons. And I
wonder, by the way, I just wonder what he would think about Newton's writings when they're 500 years old. Does the fact that time has passed make the writings less true? It's such a strange argument. Maybe it's one thing you picked up on. I guess it doesn't matter how old the book is, how old the writings are, you know. In Newtonian mechanics, if they're sound at one time, they're sound half a millennium later, right?
Right, yeah, that's the same thing I thought.
Aristotle and Plato were 400 B.C., and they laid the foundation for philosophic thinking that is significant even in the scientific enterprise. Are we going to just toss them out because they're 2,000 years old? 2,500 years old, almost. That's silly. Well, that's a silly kind of objection, but that's what you're on to.
Right. And I thought you and the it's more of a comment versus a question, but I thought you and the other listeners who are familiar with the suicide tactic, fallacy.
Right.
Basically, Bill Nye said, quote, in the video, nobody likes abortion, but you can't tell somebody what to do. And what's ironic about that is in the video, he was basically telling people not to be against abortion. So he was doing the very thing that he was, you know, saying. And I just kept thinking about how many times you've said that very intelligent people like Bill Nye make very fundamental mistakes when it comes to moral, ethical, and spiritual matters.
Sure. And this reminds me of even the claim a woman, and this is probably what's in the back of his mind, something like a woman has a right to do whatever she wants with her own body. Well, you know, this statement is just patently false. No one has the right to do whatever they want with their own body, not in a civilized society. I remember having a discussion with a woman a number of years ago in the airport, waiting for an airplane. Somehow we got on the issue of discussion, and she made this statement. And I said, you know, ma'am, when you got out of the taxi cab and crossed that sidewalk into the airport, the government slapped all kinds of laws on your body, and you didn't object apparently one bit to all the restrictions that now apply to you. I mean, the fact is, the nature of laws is to restrict us from what we do, even with our own bodies, for goodness sake. So these many of these slogans are just patently false when you think about them for a moment. Now, is there an appropriate point that can be made from bodily autonomy? Yes, there is a point that can be made regarding bodily autonomy. I don't think it carries the day when you're talking about the life of another human being, but it's an appropriate point. But the slogan radically overstates it, and people just take it as a rule, and that's what he said. Well, you can't be telling people what to do. Really? like you're doing right now, as you pointed out, Jordan. Yes, of course we. That's the way living in a civilized society works. You sometimes tell people what they can or can't do, and you back it up with force if they won't cooperate. I mean, that's called civilization.
Right, and I think you would agree that if consistency is to be maintained, and he is speaking from this view of a woman being able to do what she wills with her body, mm-hmm. then he would support her using that body to block the entrance to abortion clinics.
There you go. Right. sure. And exactly right. Now, okay. Well, now you and I'm just what's one thing that's curious to me. I was just going to say something about what he's talking about. The right people have, and she would be interfering with another person's right, and so that's why she can't do that. She can do what she wants with her own body, but your right to do what you want with your body stops right here at my space or something like that. Notice the conversation is all about rights. Well, rights are ethical notions, actually. I mean, because it entails an obligation about how we ought to treat or act towards other people. But Bill Nye is the what? Bill Nye the what? The science. The science guy, right? Now, this does not mean that a person who has an expertise in science can't weigh in a meaningful way on moral issues. But it seems to me, Jordan, the liability here is that people like him trade on their scientific credentials to make dramatic, authoritative statements outside of their field. The right a woman has to her own body has absolutely nothing to do with any scientific issue whatsoever. You cannot determine what ought to be the case by what is the case. Science might tell you what is the case in terms of the physical world and why things work the way they work, but science is not equipped to tell you what ought to be the case. That is a different discipline. That's the discipline of philosophy. Ethics is a subset of philosophy. Now, again, I don't want to simply dismiss him because he's a scientist and he's not qualified to speak. That would be genetic fallacy. But there is this tendency to believe what they have to say, to take it in virtue of their other authority, and this would be a mistake. That would be an inappropriate appeal to authority because they don't speak with authority in that particular field. You'd have to assess their statements on their merits and not relative to any expertise they have in that particular field. This is what bothered me so much, Jordan, when all of these scientists who are Nobel laureates came out in favor of embryonic stem cell research.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact that they're really good at chemistry or biology, how does that give them the expertise to weigh in on the moral propriety of carving up a nascent human being and using the body parts for research? It has nothing to do with whether or not the research is efficacious on a scientific basis. It has to do with whether one ought to do that. It's a different question. Yet they paraded all of these Nobel laureates forward like they had something that one should take their views. And indeed, that's what all it was, now as I think about it. One should just take their views at face value as legitimate in virtue of their credentials. It wasn't like they made the case for embryonic stem cell research in an ethical fashion. And had they done that, then you can assess the case. No, they were just paraded out as notables in their field and then said embryonic stem cell research is just fine. Well, why would it be fine? It's not fine simply because you say so and you're a scientist. It's got to be reasons. And even if there are philosophers, I'd still want to know the reasons, right?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, nice, great observation.
Real quick before I go, Greg, what radio show are you going to be speaking about that on for
this
us?
This is
going to
be
Issues
Etc. or Issues ETC. It's a Lutheran station. I don't know if they have... Are there a podcast now? Is Issues ETC, Melinda, is that a podcast now, or is it have a live radio presence still? Do you know? Issues, Etc. She's getting back. Okay, so it's live online, live streaming webcast, basically, that it's posted as a podcast. But you can just check it out, and you'll find it. I'm going to be on the air tomorrow at 10, but they'll post the podcast. You can listen to it anytime. Issues, et cetera, ETC. All right?
Sounds good.
Okay, Jordan, nice talking to you. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Orlando, Florida, where I'm going to be in February. Am I going to be there in February? I am. Is that right? Is that the Ligonier Conference, February in Orlando? It looks like it is. Is it Feliz, as in Feliz Navidad?
That's exactly what I told the young lady.
Oh, is that right?
So she could have.
The young lady.
I've heard that all my life.
She's rolling her eyes, and so are we. But it's nice that you characterize it that way.
okay. It's so hard to hear over the phone.
Is it?
So I usually say like Feliz Navidad.
Yes. Is this the? Is that the appropriate way to pronounce it though? Feliz.
Oh, it's Feliz.
Okay, Feliz. Okay, good. Yeah. It means happiness, though, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Yes, okay, Feliz. Well, nice to talk to you. I'm going to be in Orlando, I think, in February at a Ligonier conference for 4 days.
Making my mission to go.
Okay, well, there you go. Check out the Ligonier website. I don't know if we have we might have it up on our website already, too. So what's on your mind, Feliz?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I truly aspire to be used the way you've been used to clarify truth. And a generational relativity.
Uh-huh.
I'm ex-military, medically retired. The only reason I say that is because, through the grace of God, my schooling up until PhD will be taken care of.
Yeah, that's great.
By the way, Bill.
Who'd you serve with?
Navy.
Okay, well, thank you for your service, Feliz.
Yes, sir. So the problem that I have is I'm surrounded by skeptics and relativists and agnostics, and it's gotten to a point where I've even decided, I've even started YouTube page and Twitter page and all that, and that's not a shameful plug. I say that to say that I truly desire to be equipped to answer all these questions, especially in a generation where no one believes truth, no one believes we can ever know. You know, everything is everything. Nothing has no anchor in reality.
Right.
And long term, if I were to fast forward 20 years into my future, I'd really want to arrive at a place to where I am truly equipped to answer things in the field of epistemology. Mm-hmm. And on a basic level, I understand the law of non-contradiction, which you you call this suicide tactic.
Well, it's employed
that,
there, yes,
Yeah, so I understand these things on a basic level, but often, especially in my immediate circles, or especially in schools nowadays, they often try to subliminally teach that there is no absolutes and there is no standard to which everyone applies is grounded. So I guess, long story short, what I'm asking is, how do I get to the point to where I can, for the most part, generally be equipped? I know there's books like your book and other books, but I'm saying it's like, is there a branch of philosophy? Should I hone in? Because it's a vast array of things from fallacy.
Oh, that's true.
To,
you're
so
right.
Like, I don't know what to hone in on.
Yeah, let me offer some thoughts here. And you started out by saying, you know, I got a problem, and that is I'm surrounded by skeptics. And having just said that you want to be more effective to give an answer for the hope that's within you, essentially, and I thought, why is that? That's not a problem. That's actually a fabulous opportunity, specifically to be able to learn how to be more effective. A person that is more immersed in a kind of a hostile environment is a person that's going to learn much more quickly how to be effective than somebody who's in a church environment and wants to reach out from the safety of a church community because they're not getting challenged in the same way. When you're in your environment, you're getting challenged on a regular basis. Now, of course, that kind of challenge could wear you down. I understand that. But if you have a plan, it can be a great benefit to you. So let's just talk about the plan a little bit. The biblical principle here is when if you're faithful in little, you have to be faithful in little before you're given more, all right? And generally, then that person that is faithful in that which is given to him will then be given more things. And it's not just that in God's providential wisdom, he is entrusting you with more since you've, in a certain sense, proven yourself to be faithful. But in the process of being faithful with the smaller things, you are educating yourself and preparing yourself to be able to deal with the other things. You're going through the process. It's not just an act of faithfulness, but it is the things you're faithful in, speaking to the skeptics, addressing those problems, that is going to be your training ground to move forward. And so there are different ways to build your foundation knowledge-wise. And this is one thing you want to do. You want to consider yourself. Here, I'll give you two principles. I've already given you one. Be faithful in little things, and you'll be given more. Actually, the way I usually express that is bloom where you're planted. And you're planted in really good soil because you're getting a lot of opposition. You're in an environment with a lot of people to oppose you. When you have a lot of people oppose you, you end up getting a lot of information from them about what they don't like about Christianity or what they think is wrong with Christianity, okay? And so that means you're going to get a clearer picture of targets that you need to address than a lot of other people who are not exposed to critics or surrounded by skeptics as much as you are. So that's
Thought about it that way. That's on point.
Yeah, it's a little more challenging in some way, but you're going to learn a lot faster.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of this may be a crazy parallel, but let's just say you were you wanted to become really good at jiu-jitsu so you could learn self-defense. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you could defend yourself better. Now, what you could do is you can get an upscale place and every week go to the training or whatever, or else you could live in a place that's pretty nasty, and maybe every couple times a week you're getting confronted by some guy who wants to take you down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, which environment do you think you're going to learn self-defense more effectively? An environment where you're getting training where you have no confrontation, your only engagement is in a training situation, or mm-hmm. when you are getting training, but every week you got to put it into play. You know, there's a guy, okay, what was that block? You know, how do I, you know, take this? You know, that's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
The place where you're getting challenged more often is the place that you're going to learn to skill faster.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. I guess my main confusion is, there's so many apologetic methods, from presupposition to the classical, and then there's so many different branches of philosophy.
Okay.
That seems all intertwined.
Sure.
To the questions that people are asking.
Yeah.
And it always seems like there's a question that one branch doesn't seem to answer thoroughly, or it always seems like I'm stuck in a circle of reasoning type pattern to where, so that's why I'm confused at.
Okay, well let me offer a thought there. First, I encourage you, don't get overly introspective about apologetic styles. To simplify the field, there is presuppositional apologetics and everybody else, okay? There are really only two basic schools. The variations between historical and classical and one-step and two-step and all these other things are very, very small compared to the difference with presuppositional. You've got evidential types who pursue things in different ways. And then you got presuppositionals that have a whole different philosophy about how to do it. Now, the evidentialist can draw, I think, effectively on presuppositional techniques. I do. I'm not a presuppositionalist, but I think it's a tempest in a teapot, and you're unnecessarily confusing things, complicating things by trying to worry about the distinctions there. Here's, I think, a better way to approach it. Don't even worry about the...
Can I ask a question regarding that? Because I've always wondered that about you, and I've searched for links, but I never quite understood. You say you're not a presuppositionalist, and maybe I understand it at a basic level, but from reading your book, it seems like you question someone's worldview to have their inconsistency shine through.
Right.
Isn't that what the basis of presuppositionalism is?
Well, that is a presuppositionalist technique, and because they focus on coherence and how things fit together well. But they are really starting from a different place. There is a philosophical and a theological difference that drives their project. And it's
is that
a little
the metaphysics aspect?
Pardon me?
Is that the metaphysic aspect?
Then? No, their metaphysical issues are dealt with in both sides. But, okay. I mean, to put it one way, they a presuppositionalist wants to start the epistemological project with the metaphysical starting place. That is, since everything starts with God, and God is at the head of everything, then we should start with God first in our apologetic, it'd be a way of putting it. And that the main problem is that people know there's a God, but they are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, which I agree that that's true. But this is the ultimate thing, that presuppositions are ultimate. And we want to show them if they live through their own presuppositions, there's a contradiction. And what they do need to do is presuppose the biblical God first, and then everything else will fall into place. I mean, I'm radically oversimplified even in those comments. Mm-hmm. But if you're scratching your head thinking, well, how does all that work out? This is why I'm saying it's not, in my view, it's not worth all that extra thought power to go into it. It's a tempest in a teapot. Here's what you do, mm-hmm. in my view, in general. You commit yourself to giving an answer and making a defense as you're able to in a communication of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you deal with the issues that come up. And whatever comes up, then you draw on your resources to deal with that issue. And if you don't know how to deal with it, then you learn how to deal with it. And if that means you got to sharpen your epistemology a little bit, or you got to sharpen your metaphysics a little bit, or your historical method or something, then you do that. And over time, you build a broader foundation. I encourage you to start with the issues and the problem of evil, or the authority of the New Testament, or the transmission of the documents, or the existence of the soul, which, no, that's more of a thoroughgoing philosophical issue.
Can I give an example of one crucial issue that I'm still trying to figure out mm-hmm. that I'm here all the time?
Yeah.
Is what is truth? Now, I've been able to show people how, you know, I'm saying I don't speak a word of English, and English is contradicting. But then they try to somehow pick how, either through science or through the unknown, how contradiction can still be true. So it's like,
there's no, well, I think that when you give the illustration, you are missing the point of their question. You know, to show that contradictions can't be true, this is a foundational thing of logic and reasoning, okay? But without going into that, here is, when people say, what is truth? I think Frank Beckwith's answer is the absolute best. Here it is. You ready?
Yes.
He says to them, do you want the true answer or the false answer? Now, what is he trading on when he offers that response? He's trading on the fact that people already know what the word truth means. They use it all the time in common parlance, in common conversation, and nobody raises their eyebrows when they make reference to the concept of truth in standard discussions. It's only when they get to these kinds of discussions that all of a sudden people become they become agnostic with regards to truth. Wait a minute. Here's the way Aristotle put it. If you say that it is and it is, or if you say that it isn't and it isn't, then that's true. If you say that it is raining and it's raining, and it is, the sun isn't shining and it's not, then your statement is true. Well, what's tricky about that? There's nothing tricky about that. Now, if you say that it is and it isn't, or if you say that it isn't and it is, that's false.
Mm-hmm.
That is your straightforward garden variety definition of truth. Philosophers call it truth as correspondence. I know that the postmodern generation begins to deny, or they want to try to deny that that's the case, but they cannot deny the definition without affirming it. And this mm-hmm. is where the suicide tactic comes in. So when people ask you... Pardon me?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when people...
Go ahead.
We got a little lag time here in the call. When people ask you what is truth, that you ask them, do you want the true definition or the false definition? That is meant to show them, well, you already know what the word actually means. Now, are you asking, what is the truth about a particular thing, and how can you know it? That's a different question. Mm-hmm. And so I need to know, what is the particular thing you want to know the truth about, and then we'll talk about how we might know that. Is it true that God mm-hmm. exists? Okay, now we got a particular thing that we can work with, and we could talk about reasons why we should believe that God exists rather than he doesn't. And if our reasons are good, then we are justified in saying, yes, it is true that God exists. Maybe we have to refine it a little bit more with other questions and other pursuits, but we can go that far based on our reasons. Mm-hmm. So
the two things I would say that I usually get stumped in, because I lead the people I talk to that same type of reasoning, probably on a little bit more basic level, mm-hmm. but I lead that people to that same reasoning. And the two things that I usually get stuck in that I don't really know what to research to be able to answer mm-hmm. is, one is, who determines what's a valid way of determining truth? And two, is there anything subjective that can be considered truth? For instance, if I say pepperoni is the best, pepperoni pizza is the best pizza, and I say that's true.
Right.
Now, some people will say, see, not all truth is absolute, well, because to me, cheese is the best pizza.
Yes, of course.
And then I get stuck.
Of course. But see, this is where the definition of terms is important and where the notion of truth has gotten corrupted. What you just identified as personal preferences, and yes, of course, personal preferences are personal. That's the nature of a personal preference. But when you think about it, if it is the case, if you believe that pepperoni pizza is the best pizza, somebody else thinks that sausage pizza is the best pizza, then you're talking about two different facts. Yes, it is best for you, pepperoni, sausage is best for him, but it is an objective claim that you believe or that you prefer pepperoni over sausage. That is either true or false. That's an objective statement, but it's an objective statement about your preference. Nothing wrong with preferences, but what relativists want to claim is that everything is a preference. But of course, when they say that everything is a preference, they are making a statement of truth, which statement they don't think is a preference. They think it's an actual truth that applies to everybody. So there's the suicide again working in there. So it's safe to say, to tell people, yes, some people have preferences for different things. There is no right or wrong about flavors in pepperoni or pizza. Everybody has their preference. But that isn't the case with everything else. So how do you know which method of truth that we use what method's the appropriate, or who's to say? Well, nobody says. You reflect on the nature of reality. Science uses a certain methodology that is refined to give us accurate statements or reasonably accurate statements about the nature of the physical world. It seems to do a pretty good job there, and it's largely self-corrective unless philosophical issues get in the way. But when you're dealing with other issues, like whether naturalism is an appropriate way of viewing the world, that's the assumption of many of the scientists, well, then you have to test naturalism in a different way. You don't test it scientifically. You assess it in a different fashion. And this is the tool of philosophy, is where we reflect on and ask questions about and apply the rules of logic to questions that can only be adjudicated by reflection. And this is where arguments and reasoning come in. The simple statement, the simple answer to the question, who's to say regarding any issue, is that the person with the best reasons gets to say. That's the way it's always been, the person with the best reasons. And if somebody even disagrees with me on that, they're going to end up saying, no, I think you're wrong on that for this reason and this reason and this reason. So they're correcting me by giving better reasons for the view. So they end up fulfilling my prophecy, basically. Listen, Phillies, I have to go. We got a quick break, and then we got some more calls. But I hope that this encourages you on the path you're on. It sounds to me you're on the right path. You just got to stick with the issues, keep asking the questions, and keep reading and studying on the things that interest you the most. And as time goes on, being faithful in those little things, you're going to be adding to your knowledge base, and you'll be adding to your ability as effective ambassador for Christ. Thanks for the call, Feliz. Let's go to a quick break, and I'll be back with you here on Stand to Reason.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
All right, back at you here on Stand to Reason. Dusty's up next. Dusty, I have never been asked this question quite this way before.
I'm sorry, what?
The one that you're going to ask is I've never been asked this question quite this way before. I have had questions about prayer, but during the break, I'm chewing on it a little bit, thinking about it. So why don't you tell us what's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks. So I was playing a group of ours at the church have been going through a Bible study on the Bible Fast Forward.
Yes.
And been excellent, and I think it was either session 5 or session 6, you were talking about Daniel's prayer and how prayer should follow the SIP model.
Yes.
And I got a little bit of pushback. People were saying, well, so there's a wrong way to pray? Is there, we don't want to discourage people from praying, and not everyone's on the same, everyone's on different levels.
Okay.
And so
They
were wondering, you know, does Greg talk more about this? Because it was you kind of just said it in passing, just real quick in the and sorry, my daughter's following me banging the wall. you said it just in passing, kind of a quick 2 minutes or so.
Right.
And so I said, well, look, I'll get some more information, and if I can't get all the information, I'll ask him.
Uh-huh.
And so I printed out your article from online. I think it was from April of 2014.
Okay.
And I kind of just went through it, and, because I was getting people saying, well, you know, this is just Greg's opinion. Yeah, it is, and he says that. You know, these are my thoughts. You say this is my thoughts. I've had trouble with prayer, and so I found that this is a really simple way to be effective consistent with my praying.
Right.
And so I was just wondering how you would respond to, is there a wrong way? Because I didn't take that at all. Like, you saying that there was a wrong way, what I understood was this is a more efficient way, more consistent way with examples such as Daniel or Moses.
Sure.
Well, and
right.
And I said, if there wasn't a better way to pray, why did the disciples ask Jesus teach us to pray?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I hadn't thought about that. What if I said to your friends, maybe we should pray to Mary? Would they say that was good or bad?
They would say we don't pray to Mary.
Okay, so there is a wrong way to pray then. That would be one example of a wrong way to pray. What if we were praying this way, I-ying, 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 and we're chanting a mantra? Would they approve of that?
There's a verse that says don't be repetitive like the Gentiles.
Right. That's actually a Hindu type prayer. It's not a Christian prayer. And it's consistent with the Hindu worldview, but it accomplishes a different end. So that would be a type of prayer that would be the wrong way to pray. Okay?
Okay.
So, and Jesus also says, don't pray in senseless repetition. You know, so there's, so I'm only bringing these up. These are extreme things. And I know your friends would say, well, we don't believe that stuff. No, I understand. But notice what we've just established. We've established there is a right way to pray and there is a wrong way to pray. Okay, I mean, we all believe in that. So now the thing is, how can we pray more appropriately or more effectively? Now Jesus gives a prayer, and I had not even thought about this. It was a great contribution, Dusty, just a moment ago. The disciples' prayer, which we call the Lord's Prayer, the disciples' prayer was a model prayer for them to pray. Why did Jesus give the disciples' prayer? Because it's a prescription for prayer. It's a way to pray. Now, if Jesus thought that any old way of praying was fine, then why would he have suggested anything? There is nothing, if any old way of praying is fine, there is nothing to teach about prayer.
Right.
Now, right now on my nightstand, or on my reading stand next to my chair, my reading chair, I have three books on prayer. I have Phil Yancey's book. I have, what's his name, from the Redeemer Press in New York. I'll think of it in a minute. I have his book on prayer, and I also have another book on prayer called Praying Through the Bible, a small one. So I have four books on prayer. Why are there, who's? Tim Keller, thank you. I have Tim Keller's book on prayer, Phil Yancey. Why are people writing books on prayer if there is no wrong way to pray? Or if there is no better way to pray? Why are people like Tim Keller writing, or Phil Yancey, or, there's a great little primer on prayer by Martin Luther. Doesn't this suggest that there are better ways to pray than others? Now, what is the reason that I'm reading these books? What do you think?
Because you think that there's a better way to pray, and
and I want to know it. So I feel that my prayer life is inadequate, and by being instructed on a better way to pray, I will improve my prayer life. Is that encouraging or discouraging?
I think it's extremely encouraging, and it's much easier than reading Jesus in the School of Prayer. Go with this short article.
But no, well, that's A.B. Simpson or somebody. I mean, that's more of a classic piece, but that's just another example. Here's somebody who prays well that's teaching us how to pray. And all of those books. So if the pushback you're getting, and I don't want to be harsh to your friends because I appreciate the raising the question, nothing wrong with that. If the pushback you're getting is based on the idea, well, there is no right way and wrong way to pray, well, they probably don't actually believe that. Because some things are just going to be out of bounds, and I gave some examples. And isn't the fact that there are books on prayer that people read evidence that some ways of praying are better? And we know that. This is why we're by the book. Further, how would it discourage people from praying? By giving the model that I gave, and you mentioned SIP, that's an acronym, and it stands for specific prayer. In other words, pray specifically, pray intelligibly, and pray persuasively. Specifically, intelligibly, and persuasively. That is, give reasons why God should act. Now, you know why I suggested those three words, given the prayer of Daniel in chapter 9. What was
right.
it? Because that's the way Daniel prayed.
Right.
So isn't it appropriate for us to go to the prayers in the Bible and see if we can discern some principles in those prayers?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so why would that be odd? I don't understand the persistence in this concern. I understand, wait a minute, maybe, who is he? That's just his opinion. Of course it's my opinion. And their opinion is their opinion, you know. Even when it comes to Scripture, that's your opinion of what the Scripture means. But weigh it on its merit. Don't just dismiss it. Well, that's just his opinion. Is it good?
Right.
I have listened to prayers, and I've prayed prayers myself. My mind begins to wander, and I start to babble. I start to babble, and I have to stop myself because I'm not praying intelligibly. Do we want to talk to people? Do we want to talk to important people the way most people or many people pray prayers? Hey, Fred, I just want to, you know, thank you. Fred, you're wonderful. And Fred, just let me just ask you there. Please, Fred, just give me this thing that I need. Just please give me this. Just do it. And boy, that's great. And I really praise you. And thank you, Fred. I mean, that's babble. That's just, but that's the way people pray. Why don't we just simply, I mean the word just there as simply, why don't we simply direct intelligible requests to an intelligent God? Let's not use God's name, Lord, God, Father, Jesus, like a punctuation mark. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I'm suggesting. How could that be discouraging? I think we ought to be telling those in our charge or teaching them how to pray. So when we have staff meetings, we just had our prayer meeting, I have instructed in the past our staff, and when new people come on board, I tell them, this is how we pray. We pray.
Did you get resistance when you were throwing that model out, or did it sell pretty well?
Well, no, I didn't get resistance, really. I don't recall. No, because when you think about it, I say, listen, this is the way we want to pray, specifically, intelligibly, and persuasively. You know what? Everybody's got to listen to everybody else's prayer. We don't want to listen to psychobabble because then our mind begins to drift. Now, we're not trying to be judgmental. We are trying to educate and disciple and train and teach. And so if we ask people to pray the way the people in the Bible prayed, how could that be inappropriate?
Yeah, it makes total sense. You often give examples of your daughters, and I was wondering if you'd like to hear one from my daughter.
You know, I would like to. I got 8 seconds before the music comes up.
Yeah,
if you're
so
quick. Go
she
ahead.
Said, how should I pray? And so I gave her the Lord's Prayer, and she said, that's a great prayer. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good.
It is. And by the way, we can pray the prayer just as it is, but the problem is praying it just as it is could turn it into a rote behavior.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what happened to me as a Roman Catholic. Our Father, all you're doing is rattling them out. So you want to say it intentionally when you pray the parts. Hey, good talking to you, Dusty. I'm all out of time.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised the question. And get back with me about your further discussions with your friends at the study. I appreciate they raised the question. All right, that's it for this hour, my friends. You're listening to Stand to Reason. I am Greg Kokel. Stay tuned. Next hour, I'm going to tell you how I became a Christian.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.